From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Joanna Brooks, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Let's say you grew up in a religious household. For many of us, that's not hard to imagine. From the time you were a child, you learned to pray, keep the rules, observe holidays and customs. At some point, maybe you're 11 or 12, or even later, 18 or 19, you realize you're different than the other kids at Sunday school. You're gay. And you face a stark choice, keep your faith or follow your heart, one or the other, not both. A new generation of religious leaders is arguing that pitting God against gay is an oversimplification both of scripture and of faith itself. Today on the program, Jay Michelson, author of God vs. Gay. He's an Orthodox practicing Jew and a gay man, and his book makes a religious case for inclusion and equality. God vs. Gay, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Joanna Brooks, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, God versus Gay. For generations, LGBT people have faced a dilemma: hold on to the religious traditions they cherish, or choose romantic companionship. Traditional religious leaders say the Bible clearly forbids homosexuality, while LGBT voices express weariness with religious opposition to gay and lesbian civil equality. Many walk away from churches and synagogues. Is there another way to think and talk about religion and gay rights? Are you an LGBT person who's trying to keep the faith? Are you a person of faith who wrestles with biblical teachings on homosexuality? Joining us now from Tel Aviv is Jay Michelson. He's associate editor of Religion Dispatches magazine and the author of the new book, God vs. Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. Jay, welcome to Radio West, and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joanna.
And we invite you to join us, too, with a comment or question. Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. You can also comment on Facebook or Twitter. Jay Michelson, let's begin with your own story. You touched briefly in God vs. Gay on your own experience as an Orthodox practicing Jew and a gay man who stayed closeted for many years. So, growing up Jewish, what kind of teachings did you hear about homosexuality?
Well, you know, Joanna, it was less about this verse and that particular word than a general atmosphere. You know, I titled the book God vs. Gay with a question mark after it, God vs. Gay, not just to be clever, but because that was a dichotomy that I lived with for really 10, 15 years of my adult life. I actually grew up in the conservative movement, which is less religiously strict than the Orthodox Jewish movement, but I became more observant, actually, as I got older. And I really did believe that coming out would be the end of my religious life, that my family would desert me, that my friends would disown me, and that my connection to God, as I understood that that word and that idea, would be lost. And, you know, it would just be an irony if it weren't also a little bit tragic,
right,
that for me, my experience was actually the 180 degree opposite, that coming out was the most religious thing I ever did.
And when did you realize you were gay? At what age?
I think, you know, like you said in the introduction, it was more of an understanding that I was different, and then fighting the truth for many years. And, you know, even after I'd had a couple of connections with other men, I still believed, well, I was bisexual and I could change. And I spent all of my 20s trying to change my sexuality, relationships with women, which never worked out for some reason or another. Of course, the real reason was obvious in retrospect. And it wasn't until really the end of my 20s that I finally just burned out. I couldn't do it anymore.
And you write that you lived in fear of being gay.
Oh, absolutely. It just didn't seem possible to maintain the religious life that I cherished and also celebrate who I am as a human being.
But you did. You did. You came out of the closet. And in your book, you describe this pivotal moment when you addressed a conservative Jewish seminary about being gay and a Jew. Tell us about that moment.
Well, just about, I guess by now, almost 10 years ago, the conservative movement reopened the question of whether homosexual activity is prohibited by Jewish law. And this was at the beginning of their deliberations. There was a day of learning, and I was fortunate enough to be able just to tell a little bit of my own story. And it was putting that together and sharing it with other people that really crystallized the issue for me personally as well.
And this is crucial because, you know, so many gay people who grew up religious end up leaving the faith. You chose a different approach. Why? What led you to stay?
I think it, for me, was a combination of factors. I really did think when I came out that I was going to have to leave. It's not that I somehow thought, oh, I can have both. I really did think I would have to leave. And it was only after coming out that I realized how wrong and incorrect that was. That actually, you know, from where I sit now, whatever spirituality is, whatever our religious tradition, however we understand that term, whatever spirituality is, it must have something to do, I think, with honesty and truthfulness, being available to love. And so it seems obvious that being truthful and honest about one's sexual orientation is a consummately religious act. But I can guarantee you that I didn't see it that way. And every day I come in contact with people who see it exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and you describe coming out as a kind of religious act. Say a little bit more about what it meant to you.
Well, you know, we have this term, the closet, which is kind of a cozy term. You know, it's kind of a nice, cozy, quiet place where we keep our clothes and our shoes. But actually, the real closet is more like a tomb. I mean, it's filled with lies. I mean, just really for listeners who might not have this experience in their own lives, just imagine lying to everybody you know about something that's really important. You know, that's not, to me, in any way compatible with a religious life, but it's also just a terrible way to live.
And you connected in your book to this biblical mandate to tell the truth, to not bear false witness. Tell me
a little bit
more about the religious fruits for you of telling the truth about your sexuality and coming out of the closet.
I think one of the things that I didn't realize before I came out was that, you know, when you lie about one thing, you're lying about everything. So it's not just like I was leading a perfectly healthy life except for this one area, sexuality. And it's tragic. You know, I meet people who have the same, who are laboring in the same delusion that I had 15 years ago. And it's really hard sometimes to find that, to find the way to get them to take that leap, because it really seems like a leap not only into the unknown, but into something awful. And it's just, again, it would be ironic if it weren't tragic, that opening up and being truthful, being available to love, to companionship, that enabled me to create all kinds of connections, not just the romantic connection I now have with my partner, but with my family members, with my friends. It was, you know, I was living in a world of lies and anxiety and fear that I was going to be found out.
And when you came out, you know, deepening your religious commitment, as well as your honesty about your own life, your romantic life, it led you further, not only into your own faith tradition, but into the study of other faith traditions as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, several years ago founded an organization called Nehirim, which is a Hebrew word that means lights. And we run programming and do advocacy work for Jewish people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And in that work, I've come in contact with other faith leaders from other faith traditions and people who have reinvented their own wheels. And, you know, it's so interesting that we come from many different religious traditions. We work with different scriptures a lot of the time, and yet the struggle is almost identical. It's just coming to see the truth of the human experience and of sexual diversity rather than the untruths of ignorance.
One thing I was struck by in your book, you acknowledge and even express sympathy for people of faith who believe that their religious commitments preclude them from supporting gay rights. So even as much as you've been an advocate among gay people who want to maintain their religious affiliation, you're very sympathetic as well to religious people who are unsure how to interpret traditional mandates against homosexuality. Why not walk away? Why not disengage?
Well, I think there are two reasons. I mean, first, I'm not going to allow other people to define my religious expression for me. So, you know, if somebody else tells me I can't do something, I tend to be a kind of rebellious personality by nature anyway. That's going to encourage me to find a way to do it. But second, and I think more importantly, there is a rhetoric that one finds in the gay rights movement that is very strongly anti-religious. And I understand that as well. You know, when you've been burned by an institution and when institutions are spending billions of dollars to take away my basic rights, you know, it's natural to respond against them. But the truth is that there are many, many millions of people out there who are neither bigoted nor homophobic necessarily, but who grew up believing a certain thing and understanding a certain way, and this feels very new to them. And
right.
I think we can do a better job of having a conversation across some of these boundaries than we've done so far.
Right, and we're going to come back after the break to some of those scriptural pretexts that people who grew up religion oftentimes are saddled with or feel a deep commitment to that inform their understanding of homosexuality. But, you know, more to the state of the contemporary debate about gay rights, you observe that many LGBT people sort of throw up their hands in frustration with religion and walk away. You know, another gesture we see in the public sphere is people simply pointing to the separation of church and state and insisting that religion has no place at all in discussion of gay rights, of equality under the law. Sometimes people even level blanket accusations of hatred against religious people who oppose civil equality. But you say that this, too, it's insufficient. It's an oversimplification. Why?
Well, again, for two reasons. First, it leads to a personal kind of split personality for all of us who are both religious and LGBT or allies, as if we ourselves have to choose sides in our own minds and in our own hearts, and that's just not true. But second, and it is more globally and in a societal level. Yeah, I of course as a lawyer and as a constitutional scholar, of course the First Amendment is important and separation of church and state is important. But this is not only a political question. You know, I think one lesson that I draw is from a different civil rights struggle, the struggle for African American civil rights. You know, Dr. King didn't go around quoting the Constitution. He quoted scripture, and he realized and recognized that this was a spiritual crisis on both sides, that there was an internal spiritual crisis that racism and Jim Crow were causing for believers. And I think, you know, this is a different struggle. The issues, it's not all the same thing, mm-hmm. but I do take a lesson from one civil rights struggle to another. And I think this is similar in that respect.
So it's not enough simply to try and separate faith from public sector conversations about LGBT equality, that there is a deeper spiritual conversation to be had here. And I think one of the things your book does is point to the ways in which all religious people need to deepen our understanding of the role of intimacy, love, marriage, and relationship in our spiritual lives. Can you say a bit more about that?
Sure. I think one of the gifts that LGBT people and that this particular struggle can give to all of us, regardless of our sexual or gender identity, is exactly what you said, really a reaffirmation of the religious value of love. So, you know, for example, sometimes you hear the anti-gay statement, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve,
right.
That,
mm-hmm.
you know, men are, you know, human beings are created male and female. But if you look actually in the biblical text, Adam and Eve were the solution to a particular problem, and that problem was aloneness. You know, the first flaw that God finds in creation, according to the story in Genesis, is that the human being is alone. And it's an incredibly important religious value to heal that very natural aloneness, which all of us experience. It's an existential condition of being human. And so for me, you know, love and relationship, it's not just romance. It's certainly not just sex. It's a fulfillment of what it is to be human.
Mm-hmm. So dialing back from the dogma, it sounds like, allows us to look at the spiritual roots of our need for companionship and to better understand an ethical component to that need as well, yes?
Absolutely. I see Adam and Eve, the story of Adam and Eve, as celebrating not just one form of relationship, but really celebrating the very capacity of human beings to love.
And also the idea of community and belonging to a community plays an important role in your book.
Well, sure, and that's another reason why I think we can't just bracket religious concerns and treat this as though it's some kind of secular issue. You know, I work with people, and I know people in my organization in Nehirim whose families won't talk to them. They'll see them at the grocery store and won't acknowledge their presence because they've come out as gay or lesbian. You know, this really is, it's amazing to me to see sometimes the twists and inversions of human behavior and of religion just around this issue. You know, the idea that someone could believe that their religion wants them to never speak again to their child.
Right.
Something has clearly gone off the rails. And that, you know, I think I want to see that and reaffirm that that's an internal theological religious crisis.
Right.
That's not something that comes from outside.
Right. I'm here today with Jay Michelson. He's the author of the book, God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. We're talking about religion and homosexuality, and we invite you to join us. What did your faith tradition teach you about homosexuality? Should the book of Leviticus have the final word on gay rights? Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or our email address is radiowest@KUER.org. We're going to take a brief break, back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Joanna Brooks, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today, God versus gay. Many religions teach that the Bible prohibits homosexuality and that gay people can choose either their faith or romantic love and companionship. But a new generation of religious thinkers and leaders is arguing it's really not that simple. What messages about love, companionship, and morality does Scripture really teach? Our guest is Jay Michelson, an Orthodox practicing Jew and a gay man, a scholar and author of the book God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. You can join the conversation. Our number is 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, and our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Now, Jay Michelson, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. We grow up, those of us who grow up religious, hearing biblical pretexts that seem to forbid homosexuality, and Scripture plays this very significant role in contemporary debates about LGBT rights. And you write in God versus Gay, homosexuality was well known in biblical times, yet the Bible is almost totally uninterested in it. There are at most 7 references to same-sex activity in the Hebrew Bible and New Testament. Jesus never mentions it. The Ten Commandments never mention it. So you're saying homosexuality wasn't a preoccupation of ancient biblical prophets, yeah?
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's a good way of phrasing it. You know, we're talking about 7 verses out of 31,005 in the Hebrew Bible and New Testament combined. This is a marginal topic at most. And I think, you know, when we turn to these 7 verses, it's not that I'm trying to make them disappear or pretend that they don't exist, but we sometimes ask the wrong question first. And the wrong question is the following, you know, well, what about Leviticus, or what about the verse in Romans, or what about the verse in Corinthians? That actually should be the second question, not the first one. And the reason is this: these scattered verses can be interpreted in any number of ways. It's very easy, and we can get to this in a minute if you like, very easy to interpret these verses in a way that they have absolutely nothing to do with gay and lesbian people today at all, not even close. But yeah. what we have to do actually is realize that we need to do that, right? So I can't convince someone of my interpretation of this or that verse unless they already recognize something else first, and that is that there's an internal religious crisis caused by the traditional misinterpretation of these verses and the reality that sexual orientation and gender identity is real. Right, so there's a desperate attempt sometimes to say, well, you can pray the gay away or you can change your sexual orientation, right? The reality is, right, but and we know this from people's experience, from their witness, from their testimony, from their lives, as well as from science, the reality is that sexual orientation is a trait. And it's impossible to square that reality with a notion of a loving God who cares about God's creatures, with values like it's not good to be alone, or justice shall you pursue, or values of honesty and integrity. It's an internal crisis.
Yeah, and you do make the case in your book that Scripture should be interpreted in context, and that for Scripture interpretation today, it's important to take into account not only new scientific understandings of sexuality and its place in human identity, but also the testimonies, as you describe them, of gay and lesbian people. But let's hold on that for a second. I want to go back to the sense of history. So in the Hebrew Bible itself, in the New Testament, we find maybe 7 verses that, you know, address or appear to address homosexual behavior. It was not a preoccupation, your book argues, of, you know, ancient prophets. When does homosexuality emerge as a moral preoccupation of the Jewish and Christian traditions? How far down the historical line does that happen?
That's a great question. The answer is basically the day before yesterday in religious time. You won't find hardly any sources in the Jewish tradition until the 19th and 20th century. In other words, until the notion of homosexuality, a term which was invented, you know, in the late 19th century, was invented. you know, it's kind of cutesy to say so, but sometimes when people ask, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? The answer is nothing, right? This is a term that was invented, a new way of understanding sexual behavior that was invented at the end of the 19th century. And it's actually only in reaction to that that religious traditions become so preoccupied with it. Even the word sodomy, right, in the Christian tradition came along in the 11th century, which is fairly late. And previously, any form of extra sexual expression, whether it was same sex or opposite sex, was seen as a form of luxuria, not sodomy, but luxury. Like eating too much food or enjoying fine wine is a form of luxury. So any non-procreative sex was seen as the same way. And it really comes along quite late.
I want to read a comment from Doug in Logan, Utah, who writes, if you look at Leviticus, remember it was the Catholic Church which chose the books in the Bible. Other books were left out. It was men who chose what the holy book would be. And let's go a little bit to Leviticus, because when homosexuality does emerge, you know, as a concern, it's to the book of Leviticus that we often turn, Leviticus 18 and 20. Could you give us a different reading or give us your reading of those verses?
Well, sure. It's not actually true that we turned to Leviticus until the 1950s, right? So very, very recently, the Catholic Church and Protestant denominations as well never looked at Leviticus. They only looked at Romans and Corinthians in the New Testament. And the reason is actually obvious, right? You can visit a website called GodHatesShrimp.com. And the point of GodHatesShrimp.com is that Leviticus also, and Deuteronomy as well, prohibit shellfish, right? In the same word, this Hebrew word toeva, that sometimes is translated abomination, the same word that's used to refer to male sexual activity between two men is also used for shellfish and for mixing linen and wool, right? So, and a number of things which Christians do not consider themselves obligated to uphold. So, you know, there should be, if the Christian right and so-called Christian right is concerned about abominations, they should be protesting outside the Red Lobster, because there's far more abomination taking place in there than in any gay club in the country.
Well, fast forward to the New Testament. Let's talk about some of the Christian pretexts that are cited as forbidding homosexuality. Paul warns Christians in Roman and Corinthians against licentious behavior, and that appears to include homosexuality. That's another scripture that's often cited as a pretext. Can you give us your reading on that?
Sure. So there's two. There are these two, actually three instances: Romans, Corinthians, and Timothy. Timothy just copies what's in Corinthians. In Corinthians, Paul is arguing, sort of preaching at the Christians who live in Corinth, which was known as actually the most lascivious. It was kind of the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean.
Yeah, you write that ancient Corinth would make Vegas look like Disneyland.
That's right. And he was arguing that the Christian community should separate itself from the pagan community. And he gives a laundry list of things that the pagans do that the Christians used to do before they converted, before they accepted Christ, converted Christianity, and that's why they should stay away. And it's a laundry list of things like lying, gambling, adultery, stealing, and also two forms of sexual expression. And it's how we decide to define those terms, arsenikoitoi and malakoi. These are two terms. Malakoi usually refers to people who are soft-willed, which, again, until the last 100 years, referred actually in the Catholic Church to people who just didn't control their sexual impulses. And arsenikoitoi are people, men who have sex with men. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, well, what's he talking about here? He's listing a laundry list of lusts, right? There's a whole list of lusts. Is a loving relationship between two men or two women, in this text, of course, he's only even talking about men, is a loving relationship more like gambling and more like stealing? Or is it something else entirely? Obviously, he's not actually even commanding, telling the Christians, you know, thou shalt not X. He's saying, keep yourselves away from this lustful society, which is embroiled in all kinds of lusts, of which sexual lusts are one of them. And adultery is one of them, you know, as well. So here in the list of, you know, whatever men having sex with men means in this verse, it's on the same level as gambling and cheating and lying.
Go ahead,
sorry.
And this is a theme that comes up both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. You know, in your book, God versus Gay, that oftentimes these prohibitions against homosexuality, or what appear to be prohibitions against homosexuality, are actually boundary markers to keep a religious community away from a generally lustful, non-religious world.
And that's exactly what Romans is about as well. Paul in Romans is telling the Christian community in Rome not to give so much credence to the Roman Empire, which, of course, was the most powerful political empire of its time. And Paul says, you know, the Romans should have known better. They could just look at the world and they should have realized that there was one creator of the world. But instead, they turned away from that. And as a result, they were given over, again, to a laundry list of lusts. And it's, you know, every lust you can possibly imagine.
Except
and
lesbianism.
That includes that, well, so right.
You
well,
note in the book, actually, lesbians don't come up very much in the Bible. Can you explain?
Well, in Romans, he does talk at one point about women giving up natural relations for unnatural. And what that actually means, when we hear natural, we might think about, you know, like Darwin nature, you know, like what's natural for animals to do. Actually, Paul means the exact opposite of that. What's natural for human beings is for the spirit to rule over the body, this is according to Paul, for the male to rule over the female, according to Paul. And any time that there's an inversion of that, where the body rules over the spirit, or where men are not always dominant over women, this is what Paul sees as paraphesine, in the Greek, unnatural. So I joke in the book that homosexuality is exactly as unnatural as Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann.
Oh,
anytime
boy.
You have a female political leader, that's what Paul sees as unnatural.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. 801-585-WEST is our number. 801-585-9378. John in Ogden, welcome to Radio West.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead. What question do you have for Jay Michelson?
I just wanted to know what chastity looks like in the gay community now. And I don't mean abstinence, I mean sexual virtue. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Jay Michelson, chastity, you know, an honorable approach to sexuality, an ethical approach to sexuality. What does that look like in the gay community today?
Yeah, I think that's really an excellent question for a couple of reasons. First, there is a stereotype that every person who is gay or lesbian must, you know, be leading the wildest, craziest, most exciting sex life imaginable. You know, it should only be so. You know, it's not true, of course. There are plenty of monogamously married gay couples, just as there are monogamously married straight couples. And there are plenty of gay people who are much more promiscuous as well. You know, it's interesting. Just this past week, David Blankenhorn, who was kind of the intellectual father of the anti-marriage equality movement, right? So this was the guy who, whenever there was a court case like Proposition 8 in California, they would cite to David Blankenhorn. And he just changed his mind in an op-ed in the New York Times. And he said, you know, it's just not the case that same-sex marriage is going to destroy civilization after all. And really, people are just being anti-gay. And he kind of threw down the gauntlet. You know, he actually challenged the gay community to say, okay, so I'm willing to support same-sex marriage. Are you willing, he said, to support this other, this my agenda of marriage being important, of not having children outside of wedlock and so forth and so on. And I think just descriptively, what you find in the gay community is a wide diversity. There absolutely are many LGBT people who are not interested in that kind of traditional morality at all. And there are many who are interested in it. And I know a lot of couples who are upholding just those values.
And among LGBT people of faith, then, how are biblical commands to chastity and fidelity interpreted and applied? What kind of discussion is happening in the harem and in the communities you're involved in?
So I think, you know, again, there are many answers, and I don't want to pretend that I don't even want to take a position, you know, that this is the one answer that has to fit. I think a lot of thoughtful gay theologians are having interesting conversations about what a healthy sexuality looks like. That being said, again, I know dozens of couples personally who are absolutely monogamous and who are raising children. And, you know, for them, what we would call chastity or sexual virtue looks a lot like what it would look like for straight people. Again, there are many others who have different views, and I think it's a work in progress. But it's one, I think if we can get beyond the anti-gay animus and the hatred and all of that, we can actually begin to ask really important questions like, what would sexual ethics look like? What should they look like in the 21st century, not just for gay people, but for gay and straight people alike?
Right.
Sometimes there's a focus on homosexuality as if, well, that lets us take our eye off of the of those who are heterosexual.
Right.
And really, it's a distraction. And I think the question kind of goes to that there's actually a more interesting conversation that's ahead of us.
It's happening for us on our phones. There's certainly a lot of ethical questions that are raised when we open up the conversation around companionship and sexuality beyond these biblical pretexts, you know, to really examine what an ethical, moral approach to companionship and love would look like, as you argue in your book. Let's hear from Brad in Salt Lake City, Utah. Brad, welcome to Radio West.
I was wondering what your opinion would be of a young man who is Christian faith, strong in his faith, and admits same-sex attraction, doesn't necessarily consider himself to be quote-unquote gay, fully admits it, though, but he really wants to keep his faith, and he wants to keep his wife and child. You talked about honesty. You think that he's being dishonest in his approach to his family life and his faith?
That's a really sensitive question, Jay Michelson. How would you respond?
Right. So, you know, it depends on the specific situation. In the situation that was just described, if somebody's got a wife and a child, you know, I'm not going to, you know, judge not lest ye be judged, right? I'm not going to sit in judgment of that person's decision. I think if they're honest with their wife and they're truthful about the nature of their sexuality and their sexual orientation, I'm not going to sit and judge and tell every single person that they need to come out and disrupt their family life in order to lead a life of integrity. I'm much more interested in preventing that situation in a way from arising in the first place. I do know a lot of people, primarily actually in the Jewish community where I work, who were married, in a heterosexual marriage, and were not able to kind of make it work. And I know so many broken homes that could be prevented from happening if we would just if we could be honest in the very beginning. But in the situation that the caller described, you know, again, I'm not going to sit in judgment. I think honesty looks like, and integrity looks like different things to different people. And if somebody is concerned about the welfare of their child and they want to stay in that family situation and they're being honest and truthful with themselves and with their wife, you know, I just, that's their decision. And I respect that. But I think we can lessen the amount of suffering that happens in those kinds of situations by being honest before they even arise.
And Jay Michelson, that's one of the arguments of your book, God versus Gay, is that scripture should not be read literally and in isolation from context, but that these real world questions and experiences are a crucial lens for interpreting biblical ethics. Can you say just a little bit more about that?
Although, I want to put a little asterisk next to what you said, actually. I do read scripture literally. I'm not one of those who say that we need to throw out the literal meaning of the text. So, for example, in Leviticus, the literal reading of Leviticus deals only with one sexual act between men. Right, so that's the literal, what's on the surface of the page in the Hebrew, right? The English and the mistranslation from the King James is a different story. But, you know, if we had more time, I could go word by word through the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And what's it's classified as a very particular kind of problem, not abomination as the King James translates it, but toeva, which basically means a taboo related to idolatry. And this text literally, just reading the words, literally is about male sexual activity of one particular type in the context of idolatry, which we know from other biblical sources in Deuteronomy and elsewhere was part of Canaanite ritual, was all kinds of pagan cultic sexuality. That's the literal reading. That's not me, you know, fudging, mm-hmm. and it's not even me saying, well, you know, there are various people who pick the books, and so we don't have to listen to it, because I want to be able to have a conversation with someone who's not willing to depart from the literal meaning of the text. And if we actually read it literally, like Paul says, the truth will set you free.
Brad, thank you for your call. Jay Michelson is our guest today on Radio West. Our subject, God versus Gay. Is the religious case against same-sex marriage truly grounded in scripture? Can faith make a case for gay rights? We're going to take another brief break, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Joanna Brooks, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. We're discussing new ways to understand the relationship between religion and homosexuality, and we hope you'll join us. Are conservative people of faith and LGBT people talking past each other in contemporary debates? Is there a better way to discuss religious values and gay and lesbian concerns? With us from Tel Aviv is Jay Michelson, author of God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. You're welcome to join us as well. Our number is 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. J. Michelson, your book does not set out to dismantle the religious case against homosexuality. You're not just about debunking Leviticus and Romans and Corinthians, but rather you're trying to engage and even enlarge our religious thinking about companionship, love, and ethics. And there's a great email I want to read to and get your response to. Ryan in Salt Lake City writes, "What exactly is God's relationship to sex and desire? What gender is God, and why would God care what gender any of us are?" Jay Michelson, do you have a response?
Well, I have a response, but it'll take a long, long time. So I'll try to. That's a great email and a great question. You know, I think the question of desire is so important. I think for me, sexual diversity and gender diversity is like other forms of diversity. It's part of the beauty of nature and the beauty of our reality. You know, when we look around a natural setting, it could be a desert, it could be a forest, wherever we are, and we look around, we see all kinds of diversity, all kinds of difference and multiplicity, and that's what makes an ecosystem thrive. So, you know, I hesitate to ever kind of read the mind of God, so to speak, but the world around us is one that is filled with diversity. And this is just another form of that. And I do really recognize, you know, that we should, there is definitely a desire that a lot of people have to just say to heck with religion, I don't want to hear it anymore. But we should realize that for religious folks, this does feel very new. And the message is that while it is new or may seem new, it's actually, these are gifts, right? These are gifts to all of us to consider. And some of those questions about gender and God, there's a whole discipline now called queer theology, which is LGBT people thinking really rigorously. There's a great book by my friend Patrick Cheng called An Introduction to Queer Theology, which is a good first resource. And in my book, I kind of go through in the index, there's about 20 or 30 of these kinds of studies and scholarly studies. You know, these are really interesting questions. I'm in Israel right now because I'll be presenting at a conference on Kabbalah and the Jewish mystical tradition. And, the Kabbalah has all kinds of fascinating things to say about gender and about how gender can change for individuals and even the genders of God. It's a very audacious discourse, theological discourse. And, you know, this for me is kind of the good stuff.
Right.
If only we could just get to that. But obviously, in order to kind of have that kind of really interesting conversation, we do first need to recognize that we're having this conversation in the context of all kinds of real suffering. And I'm very focused on that. I chose to devote the last few years to writing this book and touring across the country and talking about this book because people really are in pain. And it's amazing to me how much that endures and how much suffering there really still is.
And this is a significant component of your book, God versus Gay, not just about providing greater context for and maybe dismantling some limited readings of biblical pretext, but also pointing to the very many religious reasons we have for advancing the well-being of gay and lesbian people and their concerns. Can you say a little bit about the religious ethics and mandates you think that support LGBT equality?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Religious Case for Equality. And it's the argument is that religious people should support equality for LGBT folks, not despite religion, but because of it. That the overwhelming majority of our religious values, we've mentioned a few of them, we talked about honesty, also compassion, also companionship and justice, you know, these are the important values. These are the ones that are in kind of bold face, and those support full inclusion of people who have different sexualities and gender identities. So I think it's not that we have to compromise in some way our deeply held values in order to kind of work for equality. On the contrary, we're trying to fulfill those values.
Right. And to deepen the conversation, we have caller Rick on the line from Richfield, Utah. Rick?
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Jay, for your work and insights in this area. I'm a Catholic church here, a Catholic priest here and church in central Utah, and particularly encouraged by your insight that I think you're saying to some extent that we, in general, regardless if we're gay, straight, or anything in between, tend to just understate what it means to be a sexual person in general. That the real need, I think, of our age, and I think you're getting into it perhaps in your conference where you're at now, is that you know, we're sort of living in the mystical age, or should be. And the inroad into that conversation of mysticism is intimacy. And the great problem of our age, I think, is that we've been so overwhelmed with base and pornographic sexual imagery of all kinds that it's almost kind of shorting out our capacity for the deeper mystical realm of experience.
So there's a deeper
perhaps
conversation.
Perhaps you've read a lot of mystical literature. I've read certainly a lot of the Catholic saints that we consider mystics, and when they talk about their own experience, it sounds almost erotic the way they describe their deep personal encounter with God.
No, absolutely. I think that's really on point. And, you know, reading the, I did start out as a student of mysticism, and I really, I'm in full agreement that this is a beautiful love-soaked literature. And, you know, I think, too, of some of the it's particularly in the Catholic Church, you know, John McNeil, for example, writing some really wonderful material on this subject and around homosexuality in particular, that, you know, there is something too, I think, the traditional religious critique of our society's attitude towards sexuality. And I'm not particularly conservative in my own politics, but I have a lot of sympathy for the conservative critique of the vulgarization of sexuality and of desire and the objectification of women that takes mm-hmm. place, you know, every day. And I think it's ironic, you know, sometimes like gay rights and equality for LGBT people is somehow lumped in with, you know, the latest, I don't know, Britney Spears scandal or something. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, where I'm coming from is looking for a real affirmation of spirituality and sexuality.
801-585 West is our number, 801-585-9378. Diana in Salt Lake City. Go ahead. You're on the line with Jay Michelson.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I was married to a man for 15 years who was homosexual, and I think that the impact of society telling him that he had to try to be heterosexual, wanting to start a family, all those things led him to what became a life of deception. And I'd just like to say I'm opposed to us pushing heterosexuals to marry outside of what their sexual desires are.
Thank you, Diana. Jay Michelson, go ahead. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I want to first just express a lot of compassion, you know, for that situation. I know Orthodox Jewish people who are gay, who are men who are gay, and they want to marry women, and they're not willing to tell their fiancés their supposed struggle with same-sex attraction. And, you know, it's testimonies like the one we just heard that I think are so important. I mean, that short, relatively short comment is an incredibly important religious testimony, right? That it's not just an individual's decision. There are at least two people, and then if there are children, even more people who are impacted by this decision. And, you know, for every one case where, like the earlier caller said, where, you know, somebody's come out and they've told their wife and she's working with him and so forth, for every one of those cases, I think there are probably so many more, like the one we just heard, where there's been deception at first and it leads to intense suffering.
And this is one of the arguments you make in God versus Gay. Again, that scriptural pretext should be interpreted through this lens of human experience, through these testimonies. I believe that probably comes from the Jewish tradition of Midrash, doesn't it? Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Actually, you know, I really took it more from the Protestant tradition of witness.
Ah.
to be honest, you know, that we are a witness to the faith, and we tell other people, like, our testimony has religious value.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think, you know, and it's almost, it's not even that we're interpreting the scripture in light of these testimonies. We're trying to just understand what it could possibly mean. So, you know, if there were a verse that said every time you wear a purple shirt, you must be sinful and depraved,
mm-hmm.
we'd have to really be puzzling that one out. You know, well, what could that mean? I mean, there are people who wear purple shirts all the time, and they seem to be perfectly ethical and good people. And likewise here, you know, there are texts which are interpreted as saying, well, if you're gay, you must be sinful and terrible. But there are plenty of very ethical, good, caring, loving, and even chaste, to use that language from the other caller, gay and and lesbian people. So it's less interpretation and more just noting this internal crisis that we have to be getting these verses wrong if we really believe that no same-sex intimacy can lead one to holiness, because that's just factually untrue.
Okay, let's take a call from Jeff in Salt Lake City. Jeff, you're on with Jay Michelson. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was just going to make a quick question. It's a conflict of laws issue, actually, and it deals with the fact that Paul, for example, gives a laundry list of activities which should be prohibited by his particular Christian sect at the time, and one of them is homosexual or sexual relations between men. He doesn't specify lustful or any, he doesn't give it any adjectives. Yet on the other hand, there is love, compassion, companionship. And how do you resolve those, that apparent conflict of law situation within the canonical scriptures?
Jay Michelson, how do you resolve the conflict?
That's a great way of putting it. As a lawyer and a one-time law professor, I like hearing conflict of laws too, that way of putting it. We have to recognize that it would be a contradiction, just like the caller said. On the one hand, Paul's talking about love and companionship, so he can't possibly mean in these other verses to forbid love and companionship, because those are his own values. And so when we just read the verse literally on its face, we see that what he's talking about are certain kinds of lust, and that's what he's condemning. You know, there's an irony here, which when Paul writes in Romans, he says that people were given over to lust, and that's when they turned away from God, according to Paul. And I actually had that experience myself when I was turning away from my own truth, when I was turning away from what was true for me about my own sexuality. The kinds of sex that were available to me were not so ethical. They weren't personal. They certainly weren't durable, right? I was in the closet. I was afraid of being found out. So the only kinds of sex that I would allow myself to have would be anonymous, one-night stands, and so forth. So I do actually understand what Paul's talking about. When you turn away from what's true, you're given over to forms of behavior which are not nourishing. And that, to me, feels like the plain meaning of what Paul's talking about.
Jeff, thank you for your call. Jay Michelson, gay marriage is on the ballot in Maryland and Washington this fall, and there are actually poll numbers that suggest that voters in Maryland at least, may very well approve it. It would be the first victory for same-sex marriage by referendum. And we see conservative religious denominations sort of carving out a defensive position, stressing the importance of religious freedom as public opinion gradually turns to support equality under the law for gay people. So how do you see the future of religion and the gay rights movement?
So, yeah, it's a great point. I think the rhetoric of religious freedom is a canard. It's a smokescreen. You know, there's the language of religious freedom has been used to defend bullies. I would just ask Christian listeners, who would Jesus bully exactly? You know, when I look over the Gospels, I'm a nice Jewish boy, but, on this one, I'll go with what Jesus has to say about being kind to those who are weak, not bullying those who we perceive to be different. So, you know, this language or rhetoric of religious freedom is just being used, and it's being used as a kind of a cynical ploy. I think where we're headed in terms of religion and sexuality, actually, I'll go to what President Obama said when he discussed his change of heart on same-sex marriage. You know, what he described and the way he talked about it, I think, was important, because he talked about it really as kind of a spiritual journey. He had one view, and then he just saw, you know, from the parents of his children's friends, that this, it just wasn't making sense. It just didn't seem fair. And, you know, I really do think that Americans have a pretty basic sense of fairness. And when we understand that this is just unfair, that this is taking couples who love one another, you know, and treating them unfairly, I think we respond to that. I'll just give a little bit of an anecdote. I'm here in Tel Aviv with some friends of mine, one of whom, it's a same-sex couple, one of whom is an American citizen, the other whom is an Israeli citizen, and they can't live in America because the federal government won't recognize their marriage. And so my friend's partner, who's Israeli, can't stay in America legally. So they're living here in Tel Aviv, which Tel Aviv is a great city. It's a great place to live, but they want to live in America, and that's where their work is. And you just see the very real world. That's a very simple kind of example. There are people who are suffering much more than that. But you see the real world consequences of these views, that they affect real people. And I think that's what's actually behind this shift nationally. originally. And I think, you know, they're reading the writing on the wall now that David Blankenhorn, as I mentioned, has changed his view. There's really almost no intellectual credibility left to the opposition to civil marriage, which is different from religious marriage. There, it's a very different story. There's really not much credibility left, and I'm actually very optimistic on these ballot initiatives this fall, even in Minnesota.
And beyond the civil sector questions, you know, let's wrap up. You conclude your book, God versus Gay, with the argument that even after issues of equality and the law are resolved, the work that is left to be done in religious communities towards greater inclusion and equality will ultimately be good for communities of faith. Can you say a bit about that?
Absolutely. I think, as I said before, sexual diversity is another kind of diversity, and diversity enriches our communities. So as a man, I cannot imagine my religious worldview without the contributions of feminism and a feminist theology and so forth. So feminist theology wasn't just for women, and LGBT theology, thinking about these issues, is not just for gay people. All of us are enriched when we have a richer conversation about love and about desire and about the differences between us, which we should celebrate. I think, you know, there's an anecdote that I do tell in the book, taken from Huckleberry Finn, where Huck Finn has been told that if he doesn't turn in Jim, the escaped slave, he's going to go to hell. And after a lot of thinking, Huck basically decides, well, then, you know what, I'll go to hell then, rather than turn in his friend. And we know, of course, that that's not him going to hell, but that's him. That's his salvation, not his damnation. That's when Huck becomes an adult. And I certainly had my Huck Finn moments, and I think a lot of us have that invitation to realize that, well, yeah, actually, the stirrings of conscience are more profound than any simple dogma can explain.
Jay Michelson, thank you so much. Our guest today has been Jay Michelson, author of God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Joanna Brooks.